From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear from a Mexican journalist seeking asylum in the U.S. after reporting on military corruption in his homeland.
This can be a very dangerous profession in Mexico, as I believe there might be some 130 journalists that have been killed in the last 10 years.
A Detroit native playwright has been selected by the MacArthur Foundation for a Genius Award to use as she likes.
It also means that I get to invest in other ideas and projects that I'm really passionate about.
We hear from an economic forecaster about Michigan's economy, the state budget, and volatility.
Michigan's economy is more volatile than the average state's, and the reason is because we're more concentrated in the manufacturing industries.
And Republican candidate for Governor Bill Schuette and his thoughts on taxes and the budget.
We need to be a place where people want to come because we have lower taxes, more jobs.
And politics and money in Michigan Supreme Court judges' elections. Hi there, welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A Detroit native is among the recipients of a MacArthur Fellow's so-called Genius Award. Dominique Morisot is a playwright whose plays often examine where society and the system break down and the hardships of African Americans. She joins us now. Hey, it's good to talk to you again. First, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me here.
I was reading in the, I believe it was the Free Press, that they had a hard time reaching you to tell you the good news.
Yeah, they did. It was because they're very cryptic when they reach out to you. And so, you know, I was getting a lot of cryptic texts like, hi, Dominique, call me right back. And I'm like, I don't know this person, you know, so it was a little tricky. And it was a really busy day for me that they were calling. I kept sending them to my assistant and they kept coming right back to me. And I was like, what's going on? And then I found out and I said, you know, okay, well, that, I guess that's worth calling back for. But they really had to hit me up and say, Dominique, you really need to call us.
So what does it mean to you to be recognized by the MacArthur Foundation?
It's really special. Obviously, this is one of the most prestigious awards someone in any field can receive, but also among playwrights. This is one of the most coveted ones. For me, what it really means is that so many people had to advocate for me and speak on my behalf in order for me to get this award. Because you don't know that you're getting it, you know?
Right.
You don't do anything.
It's not something you apply for. Somebody has to nominate you. So
somebody nominates you very privately, and then it goes through a series of, they say, about 30-something people in your field who they check you out with, basically, and they, you know, find out about your work. And so that means that 30-something people in my field stand up for me as an artist and can advocate for me to continue to do what I do. So that's what's really special about this award for me.
Well, we've only got a few seconds, but I wanted to ask you, this Genius Award amounts to $625,000, and the only thing that MacArthur Foundation asks of recipients is to continue to innovate, take risks, pursue creative vision. What's that look like for you?
That money is over the course of 5 years, and so for me it means that I get to continue to be an artist and create work without having to look for something supplemental, but it also means that I get to invest in other ideas and projects that I'm really passionate about, and I get to invest in myself as an artist. I get to produce some of my own works. You know, I have work in different mediums, work I want to do in Detroit, theater companies that I'm working with in Detroit, and this is a way that I get to support them and support some important artistic initiatives that I want to do in my hometown and across the country, really, and so I'm really excited about that.
Dominique Morisot is one of 25 recipients of the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Award. She's a playwright, a native of Detroit, and a graduate of the University of Michigan. Hey, thanks again. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
We've been having quick one-topic discussions with candidates for governor, and today we're talking about the state budget and taxes with Republican Bill Schuette. Welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Lester. Look forward to this discussion on economic growth and tax policy. Thank you.
You've campaigned on rolling back the state personal income tax from the current 4.25% to 3.9%. That would mean a substantial hit to the general fund. What would you cut to pay for that tax cut?
Well, you know, I'm for cutting taxes in Michigan because it's high time that people get to keep more of what they earn. And the Granholm-Whitmer income tax increase was supposed to have been temporary, Lester, but there's nothing more permanent, I guess, than a temporary income tax. I want to roll it back, and I want to eliminate the pension tax as well. And frankly, I'm in Detroit to talk about cutting the pension tax and standing up for the pensions of cops and firefighters, and And quite frankly, Gretchen Whitmer is not telling the truth. She's running some ad that is not telling the truth in terms of my position on the pension tax. I want to eliminate the pension tax. I want seniors to stay here, invest, and work here. And I want to, let people keep more of what they earn and what they've saved. And so I'm clear in the air on that. I want to drive down the income tax increase to 3.9. And what does that do? It means that since 2007, Lester, it's cost Michigan families and small businesses $8 billion. We need to drive it back to the private sector instead of the government. And here's the question. Do you want to go forward or do you want to go backward? And I want to give I want to protect their wallets. Gretchen Whitmer wants to tax their paycheck.
Yeah, let's get back to my question, though, and that was, what would you cut in the budget to pay for these tax cuts?
Well, listen, everything in Michigan needs to be evaluated so we grow. If we don't cut taxes, if we're not competitive, Lester, with other states, we'll be a smaller, shrinking state. We can't afford not to cut taxes. And by cutting taxes, we'll grow jobs and grow revenues. And, it's a $58 billion budget. And every aspect's going to have to pitch in for efficiencies and reductions. The point is, we need to cut taxes in Michigan if we're going to grow. Gretchen Whitmer wants to raise taxes on everything that moves. That's the Democrat ploy. And what that is, that's the ingredients to take us back to the lost decade of Jennifer Granholm. And Gretchen Whitmer was one of the key architects of that. That'll drive us. Remember, we had 15% unemployment after the failed governorship of Granholm, 500,000 lost jobs. People left the state in droves. We're not going back. We're going to go forward.
If you're cutting taxes and you've vowed to veto any tax increase proposal, how are you going to fix the roads, deal with the growing need for environmental cleanup and other needs that Michigan faces?
This state's about priorities, and that's what leadership is about, is priorities for Michigan's future. And listen, we have the lowest unemployment rate now in Michigan in decades. And this is about, are we going to build on the strength of the last 8 years, Governor Snyder and our Republican leadership, or are we going to go back to a time when we lost jobs and people left our state? That's really the issue. If we're going to win and compete against the Tennessees and Carolinas and Texases, we're going to have to grow our economy. Those states have lower taxes than we do. Those states have less harsh regulatory format. It's the 21st century. We can grow our economy, have proper stewardship for our Great Lakes that are so important. And this is the contrast in philosophies. You have the Democrats, Gilchrist and Whitmer, wanting to raise taxes and have more government mandates. When I have the private sector to have maximum wages for people instead of having more taxes, a government-run health care, mandates on wages and terms and conditions of employment, that's the recipe for economic collapse. That's an extreme message on the economy.
You brought up the Granholm tax increase. The justification for increasing the income tax during the Granholm administration was because we were in the middle of the Great Recession and couldn't balance the budget without that increase. A recent report from Moody's Analytics shows Michigan will fare much worse than most states if we run into another recession because our finances are not strong enough. So Moody's suggests it's better to save now for that coming economic downturn rather than face increasing taxes in the midst of it. What do you think of that reasoning?
I think that's the hand-wringing negative approach of those who just want to raise taxes at all costs. Let's look at it. Our challenge for Michigan, Lester, is to grow our population, how we broaden our population and more people living in our state. There's not one problem in Michigan that wouldn't be solved if we had more people, fan taxes, pumping gas, however you want to describe it. But the fact is we have 55 counties that have lost population in this decade. We're 300,000 jobs short of where we were before the Great Recession. And we rebounded. But the real question is, will we go forward by reducing taxes, cutting auto insurance rates? My gosh, we have the highest auto insurance rates in America. And that is a barrier for people to move to Michigan. We need to be a place where people want to come because we have lower taxes, more jobs, and lower auto insurance rates.
Because of a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the state sales tax on purchases from online retailers, Michigan's expecting about $200 million a year more in revenue. And usually a lot of that would go to the school aid fund. Governor Snyder thinks it ought to be spent on fixing the roads. What would you do with it?
Listen, I think it should go back into people's pockets. I believe in the private sector. I believe in that people in this state, they sit around in their say it's Wednesday night, they're sitting around their table and thinking about their finances. There's too many too much month and not enough check, and so I want to expand their paychecks. Others just want to tax it and give the money to the treasury of the state of Michigan. I'm going to protect people's wallets. I'm going to protect people's paychecks. And, you know, taxes, cutting taxes counts. It means jobs. Look at what's happening in Michigan now because we're moving the production of the Ram truck from Michigan to Mexico. When is the last time from Mexico to Michigan? When's the last time that happened? It's never happened before, and that's because in America we cut taxes with the administration and our Republican members of Congress. So lowering taxes helps economic growth, and the policies of Whitmer and Gilchrist of more mandates, the government-run health care, which how do you pay for that? It's out of people's pockets and taxes. And I want to have health care that covers pre-existing conditions but has a private sector approach to it where you can choose your doctor instead of bureaucrats can choose your doctor.
Yeah, I want to get back to the taxes and budget. A lot of people think that we ought to use fuel taxes and licensing fees to completely pay for road repair and roads. Do you think the state should continue to take money from the general fund to repair roads?
You know what? What we need to do is make roads a priority. And Lester, nobody drives on these roads more often than I do in our two peninsulas and 83 counties. And the fact is, on roads, we need to do a number of things. One, a full and complete audit and review of how MDOT spends money and allocates it to roads. Second, we need to have guarantees and warranties on the roads and bridges we build. Third, we need to have an advocate named Bill Schuette as governor who will work with the administration on the federal level and members of Congress and our senators to have more federal road funding come to Michigan. The relationships I have with the president and vice president will help our state to get more federal monies back to Michigan. And number four, Lester, we have a $58 billion budget. We're going to establish priorities, and that is roads. And we can do that without raising taxes. When Gretchen Whitmer says she wants to fix the roads, that is code language for I'm going to raise your darn taxes. The fear of Gretchen Whitmer as governor raising taxes, more mandates, is one reason I'm going to win in 33 days.
Bill Schuette is the current attorney general and the Republican candidate for governor. Thanks for your time.
Great to be with you, Lester. Thank you.
Through her campaign, Democratic candidate Gretchen Whitmer had agreed to join us to discuss her views on taxes and the budget. However, she canceled. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been interested in this question of whether Michigan is prepared for the next recession. As I've mentioned before, a recent Moody's Analytics stress test of the states found Michigan ranked 35th in the nation in the ability to take the fiscal hit of a moderate recession. To better understand this, we've asked Gabriel Ehrlich to help us. He's the director of the Research Seminar in Quantitative Economics at the University of Michigan. Basically, he's involved in the economic forecasting, and he advises the state of Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks a lot, Lester.
So let's talk about that Moody Analytics stress test. What were they looking for in their research?
Yeah, it's an interesting report. It was a pleasure to read it. And I should just mention there have been some similar exercises lately by S&P, for instance. And essentially what they asked is, for all 50 states, how would state budgets fare if a recession came? And they actually looked at two recession scenarios, what they called a moderate scenario and an extreme scenario or a severe scenario. And I think, you know, focusing on the moderate scenario makes sense for today. They found Michigan was in the middle of the pack, is the way I would describe it, 35th out of 50 states, as you said, but in the bottom half. And essentially what they said is Michigan does not have enough money set aside right now to totally offset the effects of a recession on the state budget.
Now, there are lots of really complicating factors about a state budget. Did this research look at all the factors that go into an assessment of how well a state can weather? And when we say state, we mean state budget. We mean state
That's
government
right.
can weather a recession.
You know, I thought it was a very good report. I thought it was fair. There was one issue that this report did not consider, which is flexibility on the spending side. So this report really looked at assets in the rainy day fund and what would happen to expenditures, things like Medicaid, in the event of a recession. But, you know, one point that I like to make is if you think about your own personal finances, as experts will advise that you have, for instance, a six-month emergency fund. But they wouldn't tell you, well, hey, if you get laid off, keep spending like you did before because you've got that 6 months in the bank. If a negative thing happens to your finances, you would still need to cut back. And that's what I think the Moody's report didn't really get at too much is, look, is there flexibility built into the state budget where it could cut back if a shock hit? So what I would say is these rainy day funds are really meant to kind of help you get to that adjustment. They're not meant to totally substitute for any need to adjust.
Well, let's talk about Michigan's economy overall. Why does it seem that it's more volatile than some other states when we do hit an economic downturn?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lester. And I think that's exactly right. Michigan's economy is more volatile than the average state's. And the reason is because we're more concentrated in the manufacturing industry. So the manufacturing industry is very sensitive to recessions and the business cycle. And because Michigan actually makes a lot of things, and especially in the auto industry, we see that employment in Michigan is more volatile than in the average state.
So revenues go down during a recession, expenses go up. You talked about the flexibility, but I wonder if anybody's factored in the fact that we've got like $2 billion worth of tax credits we still owe manufacturers because of promises made during the last recession. Is that factored into Moody's analytics?
And that's certainly something that the state keeps careful track of and that we keep track of in our forecasting. There's no question that those liabilities are still on the books. It's a perennial issue every year. That is, you know, factored in typically to budget projections, and it's definitely something we need to be aware of.
Where does the state get good marks in its stress test? You mentioned flexibility. Where else does it do well?
You know, what I would say is it's really the trend is very positive for Michigan. So if you look at Michigan's rainy day fund, you know, coming out of the last recession, it was basically at zero. And at the end of fiscal 2017, they have more than $700 million socked away. So, you know, certainly making progress, even if we're not quite where we want to be right now.
During the last recession, there ought to have been lessons learned there, right? And so we've got the rainy day fund. That's one reaction. The Granholm administration at the time did approve tax increases because the budget was falling short. It was a bipartisan decision. They cut the budget in some areas, but we're still trying to catch up in some of those places, like fixing infrastructure and sharing revenue with municipalities. If nothing changes now, what do you see happening in the state in the moderate recession scenario?
The first thing I want to say before we talk about the recession scenario is, you know, because of commitments that the state has made, for instance, if you think about the expansion of the homestead property tax credit or the transportation funding package, both of those are going to earmark revenue away from discretionary uses or the general fund.
The general fund, right.
The general fund, that's exactly right. And so we're really in a situation, if you look at the state's last estimates from May, we see personal incomes in the state growing at a pretty good rate, above 4% over the next few years. We see general fund revenues averaging only about 1% growth, and that's without a recession.
I saw somewhere that the general fund revenue is, when you adjust for inflation, is still less than it was back in 2000.
General fund revenue is you know, basically flat to downish if you adjust for inflation. I should say when you take into account, you know, other things like earmarks, things like school aid, the situation is a little bit more complicated. But, you know, that's a fair point. The point that I, you know, want to make is we're looking at pretty flat revenue or general fund revenue, even if things go well. And so, you know, obviously, if a recession hits, things are going to look even worse. And so it's just something that should be on the minds of policymakers in the state.
What should the next governor and legislature be looking at as far as preparing the state to weather a recession?
Lester, what I've learned in my time in this business is there's actually only about two ways to save more money and to be more ready. And, you know, the first is to increase revenues or taxes. And the second is to spend less. And of course, nobody likes either one of those things. So in some sense, economists are the bearers of bad news. But the reality is that there are hard trade-offs. Something that's coming down the road soon is that the Supreme Court decision in the Wayfair case is really going to lead to some unexpected revenue for the state.
It's about $200 million, right?
It's about $200 million per year. That's right. And that's from taxing online retailers.
And everybody's got dibs on that, right? Municipalities want that to go to them. The governor wants it to go to spending on the road repair. I talked to one of the candidates, Bill Schuette, the Republican, who wants to give that money back to the taxpayers.
Yeah, so like you say, everybody's got dibs on that money. It kind of came out of nowhere. And, you know, the state's going to have to decide what to do with it pretty soon. Of course, one thing you could do with that money is help build up our reserves for the future. But, you know, there's a reason that that's hard to do. It means that you're not spending on things that people value or else you're collecting more taxes.
All right. So I'm going to put you on the spot now.
Okay.
When does the next recession happen?
Well, Lester, we are not calling for a recession in our forecast. So for the U.S. economy, growth is pretty good right now. We expect it to be pretty good again next year in 2019. We think growth is going to start slowing down in 2020 as the federal fiscal stimulus starts wearing off. That's not to say that we're calling for a recession, but what we do think is that next year is going to be pretty good. 2020 is going to be a bit of a slowdown.
I read someplace that the mid-2020s, you can probably expect something to happen about that time. I mean, it's like looking into a crystal ball, right, though? Mm-hmm. You just don't know. The only thing you can do is prepare for it.
That's exactly right. And I should say, you actually expect this business cycle expansion to end up being the longest on record. So like I say, we're not calling for a recession, but there's always risks to the forecast. You see that in the international trade situation. There's always things that you don't necessarily expect. But right now, we are not calling for a recession.
Gabe Ehrlich is the director of the Economic Forecasting Unit at the University of Michigan. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Thanks a lot, Lester.
Six years ago, a judicial selection task force issued a report that insisted electing Michigan Supreme Court justices should not be as partisan or as much about money as it was. Well, every election since then, partisanship and money have become a greater part of electing Michigan Supreme Court justices. And this year, it's worse than ever. Here to talk about that are our Friday commentators, Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. So the League of Women Voters of Michigan says Michigan is unusual in that the Supreme Court races are so partisan. Vicki, what do you think of that assessment?
Well, we're one of several states where the Supreme Court justices are nominated by political party. In some other states, they do it differently. They have contested elections for Supreme Court justices at the beginning, and then they have uncontested elections following that until the voters decide they don't like that particular judge. So it's a mixed bag across the country, depending on what state you're in. But in Michigan, it has become much more partisan because not only do we elect our judges, but they're nominated by political party. And there is some concern, should we continue down that road or not? There is a legislative change that can fix that. So it's not in our Constitution to require Supreme Court justices to be nominated at political party conventions.
Ken, is electing Supreme Court justices too partisan these days?
Well, I don't have a problem with electing judges. I think the Michigan system is incredibly schizophrenic in that other than the seven Supreme Court justices, all other judges in Michigan are nominated on a nonpartisan primary ballot, and then they run in the November general election. But the Supreme Court candidates, they're nominated in the most partisan way possible, which is at the state conventions, Republican and Democratic, and then supposedly, you know, and it's just kind of a fig leaf, they're running on the nonpartisan ballot in November. I mean, I can't imagine a more schizophrenic process. We say they're nonpartisan, but we nominate them in the most partisan fashion, and I just think that's screaming for change, if you will.
I've talked with a former justice and a current justice about all this dark money being spent on ads attacking the candidates. And they both said they oppose these outside groups playing surrogates. They're supported by unknown donors buying ads, even if the ads favor them. The justices don't like it. What can be done about that?
That's a totally different problem. There is a tremendous amount of money flowing into elections from special interest groups without their donors being identified. That's not something that was established in the state of Michigan. It goes directly to the federal Supreme Court ruling of Citizens United, stating that it's a free speech right to spend money on elections, and we created this system of dark money. I think everybody who contributes to the election of a candidate should be identified, and that corporate spending is very damaging to our elections. And I also agree that we're spending way too much money on negative advertising, which really hurts the image of the court. And we're kind of used to that in normal, everyday elections of state reps and state senators and things like that. But it's just wrong.
Ken, the other thing that is of concern about this dark money is, you know, we may not know who's putting up this money for these ads, but the justices might know, and that could influence them in a case if they have one of those donors come before them. Is that a concern to you?
Well, if you have elections, you're going to have money involved in elections. As Vicki pointed out, the U.S. Supreme Court has basically said that's a free speech issue. Where the, both the state and the federal Congress could weigh in, though, is insist on disclosure so it's transparent who's given money to influence elections in all cases. But if you're going to have elections, you're going to have campaigns and you're going to have money involved. But if you have disclosure, I think that's probably something that both the state and the federal legislators, state legislature and the U.S. Congress, could see happen. I don't think we ought to just appoint state Supreme Court justices and not have them run. I support the idea of having them on the ballot. You know, the national model, given what's going on in Washington, of lifetime appointments, you know, isn't any better. So I do support the idea of elections, but, you know, let's have disclosure of all contributions.
I want to talk about something that's happening this year. Michigan Supreme Court Justice Elizabeth Clement was appointed by Governor Snyder. She's up for election this time. And she ruled on something that her party, the Republicans, really didn't like. Now she's being, barely got a nomination. They're eliminating her from some political literature in some cases. She says she was intimidated during this case that was before her. What do you make of that, Vicki?
Well, there were two cases that were problematic for her from the Republican Party establishment standpoint. And that was when she ruled that schools could be gun-free zones should they choose to ban carrying guns on school property. And then she ruled to allow the redistricting proposal to be on the ballot in the state of Michigan. The Michigan Chamber of Commerce and the NRA weighed in, and they're big funders to the Republican Party. They got very angry, and they decided that they weren't going to fund Justice Clement's reelection campaign. And this is part of the problem when you have partisan nominations of judges. They feel like they have to toe the party line. I applaud her for being an independent justice. That's what we want on the court. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it shouldn't matter. Justice is justice, and they should be applying the law in all cases and the Constitution to verify whether something is legal or not in the state of Michigan. But these are the kinds of problems you get when you have partisan nominations. And I agree with Ken. We can fix this in Michigan.
Ken, what do you make of this bullying and intimidation of Justice Clement because she ruled on a case differently than they wanted her to rule?
Well, it's outrageous and unacceptable. But it's the most recent event, I would say, that has exposed this fundamental flaw in the current system. You know, all other judges in Michigan, appellate, circuit, district court, they don't get nominated at a partisan convention. They get petitions. They run in a primary and a nonpartisan ballot. And if they're successful, they go to the nonpartisan ballot in November. So what has happened to her, which I would say, just for the record again, it's just totally unacceptable, is exposes this fundamental flaw. And, you know, it wasn't too long ago that the late Chief Justice Betty Weaver proposed a system and a process to do away with this, where you have seven districts for the Supreme Court in Michigan. They get petitions like other judges do. They serve a 14-year term. That would, I think, make the system a lot better and remove this total schizophrenia about nominating at a partisan convention and then supposedly running on a nonpartisan ballot.
There have been several solutions offered. In fact, I mentioned the Judicial Selection Task Force from 6 years ago. That report outlined ways to make it less money, less political. Why isn't the legislature listening to some really wise people who understand this really well? That committee, that task force, had a lot of prominent people in there, including former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Why aren't we listening to them?
Because the Senate and the House are made up of partisan individuals who all want to control from the top down from their party's point of view. People in power don't like to give up power. It's a natural thing. I don't think this would be any different if the Democrats were in control or whether it's the Republicans in control. It's all about being able to elect whom they want to elect. This is a big problem, and I think the public is getting ready to revolt from political party domination and start to move to the will of the people. And I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch as we go forward. And we'll see how the anti-gerrymandering bill goes. If it passes, I would assume that somewhere down the road, people are going to take a look at judges.
Ken, why aren't we listening to advice from people like former Justice Weaver or this Judicial Selection Task Force?
Part of the problem is that making the changes that former Justice Weaver proposed is not easy. It takes a combination of legislation and amendments to the state constitution to put in place her specific proposal. So change would be extremely difficult, not impossible, but it's not easy to do. But then you have what Vicky pointed out, and that is that it also means, you know, the power to nominate justices changes the source of that power. It goes from special interests that are involved in the political parties to the voters themselves. And, you know, nobody likes to give up power.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Vicky Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Up next, journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto and his son spent 7 months in ICE detention and could face deportation soon. And no one understands why.
At some point, I think this legal process has become a personal thing for this judge. And what I'm looking for is the justice that I wasn't able to find in Mexico.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In 2008, journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto and his 14-year-old son Oscar came to the U.S.-Mexican border seeking asylum. Gutierrez Soto was a newspaper reporter who wrote about the Mexican military's behavior during a drug cartel crackdown. The Mexican military threatened his life because of his reporting. Gutierrez lived in the United States, operating a food truck, staying out of trouble, attending the mandatory check-ins with immigration officials. And then shortly after the Trump administration took over the reins of government, the Gutierrezes ended up on a list of people to be targeted for arrest. They spent 7 months in detention. No one's really sure why. The only thing that has been suggested is that Emilio Gutierrez Soto has voiced criticism of U.S. immigration policy, and he could face deportation soon. Joining me now are Emilio Gutierrez Soto. Thanks for coming in.
Gracias, muy amable.
And Luis Trelles will be assisting us in translating. Thanks very much.
Oh, of course, my pleasure.
And also here is Lynette Clementson, who is the director of the Knight Wallace Fellowships for Journalists at the University of Michigan. Mr. Gutierrez has been awarded a fellowship for this year there.
Thank you for having us.
Let's start with the backstory. In what way did the Mexican military threaten you?
Bueno, si me permite hacer un poco de historia. Escribí algunos artículos, algunas notas informativas.
He started writing some articles on instances of corruption in the military in the northwest of the country where he worked.
Específicamente hablé de un caso en donde los militares allanaron un hotel.
Emilio is telling us that it all came to a head when he wrote about a case where the military took over a hotel where migrants who were on their way to the U.S. were staying and basically robbed them. And that took the attention of the general in charge of the army in the town.
There's an important point to make here, and that is that he had the byline. His name was on the story for the first story, but in subsequent stories, it was not. And I'm asking, why is that important?
Bueno, la violencia en México se empezó a generalizar con la llegada de Felipe Calderón a la presidencia de la República.
So, starting with the administration of President Felipe Calderón in the mid-2000s, the murder rate, homicide rate shot up in terms of drug cartel violence. That's when human rights activists, civil rights activists, and journalists started getting killed. So many, many, many newspapers in Mexico made the decision to run some of the more difficult stories signaling acts of corruption or the drug cartels and run them without bylines for the security of their journalists.
Somewhere along in his coverage, he got a visit from the Mexican military. Could you tell us about that?
Sí, Fue en el mes de mayo del 2008, poco después de la medianoche, escuché uno, pensé que había explotado un transformador de
yes, it was in May 2008, Emilio thought that there had been an explosion in a local electrical unit in the neighborhood. It was actually the military breaking down the door, looking for him and his son.
And what did they tell you?
Bueno, me obligaron a tirarme al suelo en ropas interiores. Posteriormente me obligaron a levantarme, me dijeron que andaban buscando armas y drogas.
They made me drop to the floor, I was in my underwear, then they made me get up and they searched and destroyed my house looking for drugs and weapons, and obviously they didn't find anything.
So this was just a shot across the bow, a warning.
Esta fue la prácticamente la última amenaza.
So this was actually the last warning. After not finding anything in my home in terms of drugs or arms, I knew that it could be a lot more difficult later on. And a lieutenant was the only one of the military crew that came into my house, the only one that didn't have a mask on, told me that I had to start denouncing the drug cartels instead and that I should behave better.
You decided that you needed to seek asylum in the U.S. Why was that the best option for you?
No tuve la oportunidad de llegar hasta Ciudad Juárez, de Ascensión, Chihuahua, que dista aproximadamente unos...
My first option was to try to get to the Belgium's embassy in Ciudad Juárez, but that was more than 100 kilometers away from the town of Ascensión, where I'm from, and there were 3 military checkpoints on the road to Ciudad Juárez. That's when I decided to take a rural road, less than 60 kilometers, to get to the border with the United States. It was the kind of thing where I flipped a coin, and that's how it came out.
Now, an immigration judge in Texas is ruling that you should not receive asylum. You should be deported, and according to the reports I've read, the judge doesn't think you were a journalist. Why is there confusion about that?
Yo realmente no entiendo por qué está cuestionando mi función como comunicador, como periodista, como reportero. Todas las pruebas se le han presentado.
I can't understand it. We have put cartloads of evidence before this judge full of my articles. He has not read them. He has asked us to synthesize them and you know, make it into just a more manageable package. We have done that. He still hasn't read them. He has asked us for another selection. And at some point, I think this legal process has become a personal thing for this judge. It's and what I'm looking for is the justice that I wasn't able to find in Mexico.
I've seen national publications that have done articles on you as far back as 2009, and there have been a lot of articles about your journalism since then. Several prominent journalism groups have rallied around your case, and an appeal judge was very skeptical about the reasoning of the immigration judge in Texas. What do you think is really going on?
Reitero, el asunto legal se transformó en personal, pero yo siento que...
So I just want to say that, yes, at some point this legal process turned personal, and that I was among the first to apply for asylum once the violence in Mexico started to grow during President Felipe Calderón's administration in the mid-2000s. Since then, asylum claims have jumped to the thousands, especially in Texas. And I do believe that the judges have to work a lot. Immigration judges have to work a lot more. And maybe this judge is looking at a caseload that is a lot bigger than it used to be before. And yeah, we're making him work.
Next week, proof of your career as a journalist is due to the immigration judge in Texas. Several students and professors came together to translate hundreds of your articles into English. What do you think of that effort?
Oh, es un esfuerzo que yo aprecio mucho. Tengo un infinito agradecimiento. Me han demostrado que las políticas y la cultura en Estados Unidos no radica en el actuar que se está dando.
I am eternally grateful for the effort. It's hard for me to think of how I can reciprocate all the effort and the help and the, you know, of right-minded people that have showed me that there are many more good people in the U.S. society than what the official policy seems to indicate sometimes.
I have to ask you about the byline again. How much does that complicate your case when the most important articles don't actually have your name signed to them?
Yo no lo veo como algo difícil tomando en cuenta un asunto de lógica.
So I don't see it as such a difficult issue when you put it in context. I was the only journalist in this northwestern region of Mexico working on this beat following these kinds of stories. And you also have to remember that this can be a very dangerous profession in Mexico, as I believe there might be some 130 journalists that have been killed in the last 10 years, and it was a security issue in my newspaper.
Lynette Clementson, let's turn to you for a second. Why have you and others at the University of Michigan gotten involved in this immigration case?
At the Knight Wallace Fellowships for Journalists, of course, we're journalists. We're not activists, though there have been several activists and advocates who have gotten involved in this case. For us, I think it was a very simple call that the one thing we can advocate for is freedom of the press and safety and freedom for journalists in the United States and around the world. And this case was a clear one that we felt was deserving of the attention that we could bring to it and the support and credibility that the University of Michigan could lend to the arguments being pulled together. The National Press Club in Washington, D.C. has been a leader in efforts around Emilio's case. Emilio won their highest award, which may have been the start of his problems with ICE this time around, because in receiving that award in October of 2017, in his acceptance speech, he was critical of the current administration's immigration policies. That was in October of 2017. And in December of 2017, after being in the United States for 10 years, after never missing a scheduled check-in, after never running afoul of the law, he went for a regular check-in and was detained and kept in detention for nearly 8 months. And so for people who are concerned with freedom of the press, the relationship between Emilio speaking out against what he felt was an unjust immigration policy and his sudden detention with no previous activity to suggest that he was a threat in the United States seemed to rise to a level that demanded that American journalists who speak out and stand up for press freedom become involved in this case.
Why did you offer Mr. Gutierrez a Knight Wallace Fellowship, which is a prestigious position?
So our fellowship program is one of the most prestigious in the country for journalists. And in selecting fellows for the program, we look carefully not just at a person's past accomplishments, but at what they hope to do in the future for journalism. And while Emilio's past story was compelling, I could not have offered him a fellowship had I not taken a hard look at what his desires were in terms of his work and career for the future. And I went to El Paso and met Emilio and his son Oscar in the detention center and basically had an interview. I interview everyone who's a finalist for the fellowship. And the difference in this case was that I had to get permission from DHS and interview Emilio in a room with two-way glass with guards watching us. But we did an interview. And as part of that, I was looking for his intentions around his career in journalism. Did he think he had more to say? Were there things he still wanted to learn and do? If he had his choice, would he be working as a journalist? And I came away from that conversation.
Let me ask you, because when he was detained, as far as ICE was concerned, he was a food truck operator.
Correct.
How does this all play in the question about whether he should be deported?
I think it's highly relevant. It's another thing that we hope that the judge in this case will take into consideration, that while their case was in pending status, Emilio had to make a living and so worked as a food truck operator. that is different than that being his profession, his chosen profession. And his desire has always been to work as a journalist. And he would welcome the opportunity to return to a career in journalism in the United States. And in the United States, there's actually a need in this country for a journalist like Emilio. And what he could bring to reporting around border issues and to transforming communities in large swaths of the country is significant. And so for me, while I'm weighing future potential of the people who come through the program, I think that there's a strong argument to make that Emilio would make very meaningful contributions to journalism if allowed to stay here in the United States. And so for that alone, he was a strong candidate to be a Knight Wallace Fellow.
You mentioned National Press Club, but there have been several prominent journalism groups who have
many
gotten involved in this, and still the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency and this immigration judge are really not paying attention. What do you think that says about the concerns of journalists in this country?
Well, I think this particular case raises concerns for press freedom internationally and at home. And the number of organizations that have signed on in this case, specific to the details of this particular case, of course, the broader issue of asylum, there are many entry points for expressing concern about the way the policy is currently being handled. But in this particular case, as it relates to press freedom, I think that there are reasons to believe that a decision in this case also says something about the standing of the press in this country. And if for no other reason than that, I think American journalists need to be paying attention to this case, need to be aware of the details of this case, and need to think about the possible implications if Emilio is sent back to what many believe would be an almost certain death sentence for speaking out against current policy.
Mr. Gutierrez, there's another hearing before this immigration judge in Texas to determine whether you and your son are deported. If you are deported, what are your options? What will you do?
Yo espero que no nos deporten. Las evidencias son fuertes, los argumentos son reales, la necesidad de vida es auténtica.
I hope I won't be deported. The evidence is strong. The arguments are well thought out, and the fear for my life is real. So I hope the judge will get to see this and reach a new understanding.
La opción es vivir en los Estados Unidos. Si el juez llega a determinar que somos nuevamente deportables, vamos a luchar.
Our hope is to stay. If the judge decides for deportation, then we will appeal and we will try to keep appealing. It's been a long, arduous process, but we just don't have an option to turn back.
Emilio Gutierrez Soto is a journalist from Mexico who, along with his son, have been seeking asylum in the U.S. for a decade. Lynette Clementson is the Charles R. Eisendrath Director of the Wallace House at the University of Michigan. The Wallace House is the home of the Knight Wallace Fellowships for Journalists. And my thanks to Luis Trelles for translating. He's a producer-reporter with Radio Ambulante and a Knight Wallace Fellow. Thank you all very much. Gracias.
Gracias. Muy amable.
Thank you.
Michigan is sometimes called one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. Proposal 2 on this November's ballot is an attempt to change that. Well, we want to know what questions you have about Proposal 2. Go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org or call 734-764-7840. Simply tell us your name, where you live, and ask your question. We'll try to get answers to as many of your questions as we can. Again, that phone number is 734-764-7840. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's been unusually quiet, which makes me wonder what he's plotting. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Hey, have a great weekend.